For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we're at the end of the second of three sections that make up the Gospel of Luke. Chapters 1 through most of 9 is kind of setting the stage for the ministry of Christ. The second half of chapter 9 through the first half of chapter 19 really focuses on Jesus training his disciples. There are mostly lessons in discipleship through Jesus' teaching, through sending them out on little missions themselves, and through some of the things that Jesus does to illustrate what he's about, what he's come to do, and what kind of life they'll be living once he's gone. Then, and we're going to pick up on this then next week, is the final part of the book where Jesus enters into Jerusalem for that last week. And so the last week of Christ's life occupies from chapter 19 through 24 of the Gospel of Luke. It's a significant section, just loaded with kind of the crescendo as the story of Christ comes together. Tonight, we want to close out that second part. We're going to talk about the issue of spiritual perception. This is an issue that began this section in Luke's gospel, and it's kind of bookending the back end of this section as well. He begins, Jesus took the 12 aside and said to them, "Behold, we're going to Jerusalem, and all things which are written through the prophets about the Son of Man will be accomplished. He'll be handed over to the Gentiles, he'll be mocked and mistreated and spit upon, and after they have scourged him, they will kill him, and the third day he will rise again." Now, a couple of weeks ago, we looked at this same passage, and just to interact with this amazing statement that Jesus is making, he says, look, we're going to Jerusalem, and the things that are written about me through the prophets will be accomplished. And so what he's doing is he's taking the disciples' thinking back into the pages of the Old Testament, the writings of the prophets. And he says that all of these things that you are going to behold, the things that await, have all been written about me long before. What things? That I'll be handed over to the Gentiles, mocked and mistreated, spit upon, scourged, killed, and risen from the dead. Well, we're going to come back to that passage in Luke chapter 24, verse 44, where Jesus, after his resurrection from the dead, then has a little Bible study with them. Can you imagine what that would be like when he opens up the Old Testament and says, "There I am, there I am, there I am." But the reality is, he was there all along. And the weird thing is, as it goes on to say, the disciples did not understand these things, and the meaning was hidden from them, and they did not comprehend the things that were said. Jesus repeatedly says, and so in Luke chapter 9, for instance, verses 42 and 43, he tells them the same thing. This is what, we're going to go to Jerusalem, and this is what's going to happen. I'm going to be delivered over, I'm going to die, be killed, and resurrect from the dead. And they scratched their head, and they thought, what kind of a weird, you know, parable is this, or whatever. Even though we're told that he was speaking the matter plainly. So over and over, he is saying the same thing. On some level, it ought not to be much of a surprise when they show up in Jerusalem and all these things happen, because clearly and repeatedly, he's saying that this is what awaits them, and that a careful, honest, straightforward reading of the Old Testament, the prophets specifically, outline exactly what God's Messiah would do. And so it raises some interesting questions about spiritual blindness. I mean, surely if these disciples who had now been with Jesus, traveling around for 3 years, a little over 3 years, nearly 3.5 years, hearing these things, and they still didn't comprehend, they still didn't understand, what would it take to understand and to really get it? And that's what we're talking about tonight. We're going to talk about the idea of spiritual blindness and spiritual perception, because that's what this section deals with. This section kind of sets up our dilemma, our problem, the problem that the disciples were having, their spiritual blindness. We ask this question to people sometimes. Why can't you see what's as plain as the nose on your face? Have you seen that commercial? I tried to find it, but I couldn't download it. This woman has a big spike in her forehead. And she's talking to her husband, and she says, "Will you quit it already with the spike in the forehead thing?" As though somehow she just cannot see that she's got a spike in the forehead. And so there's a certain denseness that she illustrates. I'm like that. I think we're all like that in various areas. There are things that we just cannot see that are just as plain as could be. Why? Why are we this way? Let's think about that just for a second. It says that these things were hidden from them, and not in some kind of deceitful way, but it really in a way that describes that they were hidden because there was something broken in the disciples. There's something broken about all of us where our natural disposition is not to see the very important thing that God is trying to reveal. Let's look at it in Matthew chapter 13. Jesus puts it like this. He's citing Isaiah the prophet, Isaiah chapter 6. And he says, "When you hear what I say, you will not understand. When you see what I do, you will not comprehend." Wow, why is that? Because it's so paradoxical and weird, no one could get it. No, not at all. He goes on, he says, "For," here's the reason, "the hearts of these people are hardened, and their ears cannot hear, and they have closed their eyes, so their eyes cannot see, and their ears cannot hear, and their hearts cannot understand, and they cannot turn to me and let me heal them." And Jesus is saying, you know, this is what happens when people listen to my teachings. It's the same thing that Isaiah was voicing 700 years before the time of Christ. That there's something in the heart of humanity that is sort of like an allergy to really hearing from God. What does it mean that the truth was hidden from them, and that often the truth is hidden from us? I think that there are some kind of practical ways that we can think about this. One would be, we can't hear because we're so distracted. Here's a guy driving down the road with a cup of coffee in one hand, his texting on the cell phone with the other, he's talking on the phone with that thing in his ear. That's a distracted driver right there. It's not that he can't see, he could see, but his mind is somewhere else, right? So he runs off the road and, you know, knocks over the fence in front of the people's house, and it's all bad. The capacity's there, but the attentiveness is not. And so here is a reason why we may be having a hard time hearing from God. It's because I've got all these other things in my hand. I've got my own agenda. I'm driving my thing. I'm just distracted out the wazoo. And the practical things of life, those are the things that really matter to me, the things that are right in front of my face. I'm busy. I got my thing going on. And I got an agenda. And I'm working my plan, whatever that plan might be for you. And, you know, so that's really where my focus is, the idea that God would have something to communicate to me or say about my life. Not that interested. Well, maybe in an abstract way I am, but the reality is my focus is really on my thing and what I'm doing. And so I'm too busy for the God of the universe. It's really kind of an alarming thought. No one would ever say it like that, but that's the reality of it. When we have really intelligent people, like so many of us here tonight, people who are advancing in their area of work, your expertise, people rely on you, you know things, and you're excelling in these areas of knowledge, just like so many of your peers, people that you work with. And it's always struck me as being remarkable in a very spooky kind of way that people who are so advanced in their understanding of very practical things and sometimes very complicated things would have just absolutely no clue about the important things. No idea about them. No real thought about the most human of all things, which is, am I an accident or is there a God? Or what happens when I take my last breath? Those are deep questions. Those are worthy of the thinking of any thinking person. But no, because, well, I'm busy, you know, with my thing. And so that's really why Jesus says, you know, it's easier for the camel to go through an eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. He's not saying that God's making it hard. It's just that it's possible to become so caught up with and distracted by the pursuit of your agenda that God may be speaking right to you. And you're on a different wavelength. You cannot hear. That's one thought. Second, there is the problem of denial. Indeed. What is denial? Denial means that there are just some things I don't want to believe. And so maybe I've become aware of these things, but I've found ways to suppress my understanding of them. Your wife hides her drinking and smells of alcohol, but that's okay. I'm sure that there must be an explanation. You know, kids who are getting sucked into a life of drug use, things like that. Parents are remarkably able to look past what's right in front of their face. Because why? Because they just don't want to believe that this could be true of this child that I love so much. Right? Am I right? That's true. And so it is that important areas where God may be saying some things to us, the things that He may be saying to us are things that are just so hard to really digest. It's just like, I can't hear that. There's a great movie done many years ago called Ship of Fools. And it's about a group of people who take a passenger ship from Argentina to Germany in the late 1930s. And it has a dwarf, a Jew, all these other people who within a matter of years will be exterminated in Hitler's concentration camps. And they are just talking wistfully about the fatherland and about the new administration in Germany. And yeah, that book was written, but no one would ever take that very seriously. Mein Kampf, the blueprint for the final solution. All of these things just seemed so completely implausible that no one was willing to open their eyes and actually see what was going on. There's just no way that that could happen. And it did. And it did. And so God may be saying to us, hey, open your eyes. You are distant from me. You're far from me. You're not like me. And there's no way that you're going to get to me with your religious rituals, with your good behavior. You're way too old. There's way too much water over the dam. You are in an unfixable state before me. But I've got a solution to that based upon not something that you do for me, but something that I do for you. And that's good news. That's God moving toward us in mercy and dying the death that we deserve as a substitute. We can come before God with an innocence that is given to us by Christ. We don't want to hear that because why? Because we have strong vested interests in the idea that I'm pretty okay. I mean, I'm all right. If anyone's got a problem, you know, certainly an understanding God would realize I'm pretty good. You know, that's not what he's saying, but we're in denial about our true situation before him. We just don't want to believe it. The cost is way too high. Because it means yielding and humbling myself and saying, God, give me a favor. Give me something that I couldn't get on my own. No, but that's very offensive to the pride of humanity. We don't want to hear that. So some of us find ourselves in denial. That's why we can't hear. That's why we can't see. Some of us have gone beyond denial into refusal. We've just put the hand up. No to God. What does it mean? No amount of evidence will change my mind because I will not accept it. I've already decided that no. So talk away, and it's just going to bounce right off of my head. Again, there aren't that many people who would honestly say that who are in this state. Every now and then, someone is honest enough to push back. Perhaps the most influential philosopher of the last quarter century is a man named Thomas Nagel. He has a split appointment between Princeton University and New York University. He's been recognized by far as just the guy with the real influence in terms of thinking deeply about the issues of life. And he wrote a book a while ago, and an article that kind of came out of that. And here's what Nagel says about God. He says, "I want atheism to be true, and I am made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that." Well, there is some candor right there. There's some honesty being expressed. And then he proceeds to write a book called Mind and Cosmos, in which he forcefully and persuasively argues that most of what we experience as human beings is fundamentally unexplainable through purely material biological processes. There has to be something more. What do you call that? That's refusal. That's refusal to believe. I don't want there to be a God, and so therefore what? There isn't one. Unless there is. It doesn't make the problem go away. And why was Jesus so roundly rejected by the religious authorities of his day? Because they were refusers. That's why. That they could not even attribute to the things that Jesus did that with their own eyes they recognized as miraculous. Because why? Because he felt comfortable in the company of people that they called sinners. Because he talked about the mercy of God extending even beyond the children of Israel to all people. That the people who are perhaps in their own minds even furthest from the God are really closest to God because they recognize how far they really are. And these are the people that the religious held in contempt. And for them, Jesus was a deep offense to their own self-based righteousness. Refusal. Well, I think that all of us, I think, can find ourselves on a bit of a continuum in this way. God may be trying to speak to us, perhaps even right now, but we're distracted. We're wondering, what is the score of that crew match that we're going to show after this thing's over? It's okay, you can wait hours and hours, and it'll still probably be 0-0. It's, I don't know, just saying. I mean, but it'll be very interesting. You know, at the same time. But we will show it because we're just that interested. And or maybe we're just, you know, we're not willing to look at the things that God has brought in front of us. Maybe through what we've beheld in God's Word, maybe the things that people who know us well are coming to us and they're making some observations about our life and we're pushing back. Why? Not because these things aren't true, it's because we don't want to hear that. It doesn't fit into our plan for ourselves or our perception of ourselves. Or maybe we've gone beyond that just to say no. And maybe we've been saying no for so long to God that we just can no longer hear his voice. And that's the condition. The heart is a very sensitive instrument. It really is. And the attitudes that we carry affect our ability to really hear from God. And this is a problem that even Jesus' inner circle was having, as contrasted by two little narrative examples that come right on the heels of this statement and that illustrate exactly Jesus' point. Let's take a move on. He says in verse 35, Jesus was approaching Jericho and a blind man was sitting by the road begging. Now, hearing a crowd going by, he began to inquire what this was. And they told him that Jesus of Nazareth was passing by. And so he called out saying, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Obviously, he had heard some of Jesus' teaching. He had heard some things said about him. In verse 39, those who led the way were sternly telling him to be quiet. But he kept crying out all the more, son of man, have mercy on me. And Jesus stopped and commanded that he be brought to him. And when he came near, Jesus questioned him. What do you want me to do for you? He said. Lord, I want to regain my sight. That's what I want. And Jesus replied, receive your sight then. Your faith has made you well. And immediately he regained his sight and began following Jesus, glorifying God. And when all the people saw it, they gave praise to God. So there's our first little narrative. Lessons from a blind man who perceives, right? He's blind, but he sees something. He sees something that the disciples didn't see. What did he see that the disciples didn't see? What are the clues in the text? Let's think about that. First, he had a very accurate assessment of the situation. He was blind and desperate, right? To be blind in the ancient world means there's no, what possible way would there be for me to care for myself? Or if I became blind later in life, to care for my family? And so here's a man without any resources and has turned to a life of begging. That's really terrible. Really terrible indeed. And to make it worse, in his culture, to be blind and to be reduced to this place in the religious mentality of the Jews of Jesus' day, that's just proof that there's a problem between you and God. Why would you be suffering like this? There must be something you did to bring this about. So not only does he have the desperation that comes with the condition that he's in, he also has this religious overlay that's really your fault. So that's pretty tough. And what does he do? He twice calls out to Jesus using two very profound names, titles, Son of David, Son of Man, the very term that Jesus used for himself. Son of David, I recognize that you are the Messiah. That's what he's saying. I see that you're the Messiah. And so I call out to you and I ask you, give me mercy. That's awesome. He's come to a place where he just knows that he doesn't have the resources. There's nothing he can do about his circumstance. The only recourse I have is to plea to God. Give me something that I cannot get on my own. Well, if you're in that kind of a place, you can see. Okay? You can see. You can see reality for what God made it to be. You can see the reality in your helplessness that you don't have the resources within yourself to deal with the most basic issues that you face between yourself and God. You need to receive something from him, not because you deserve it, not because, man, I'm so great. What's the basis of the blind beggar's plea? Son of David, give me what I deserve. Son of David, I'm a really great guy, and surely you see my goodness. No, he just is calling out for mercy. That's all he's doing. And of course, that mercy is given. He says, receive your sight. Your faith has made you well. Jesus responds to humility. Jesus responds to helplessness. He's saying, if we're finally done with this tug of war over what the terms of this relationship are, and you're finally out of gas, and you're finally ready to say, okay, uncle, then good. I love the way the Chinese writer Watchman Nee describes this very thing. He talks about an experience he had in his life where he's walking along a beach and he's observing out in the sea a man who is flailing in the water and shouting for help. Help me, help me. And the friend that he's with was a very good swimmer, accomplished swimmer, strong man, Christian man. And he stopped and he looked out at the guy who's flailing in the water and said, And Nee's like, don't you care? Come on, go out there and save this guy. The guy's like, you know, he's taken in water, still flailing about. Come on, help this guy. Finally, the guy goes under for the third time. The guy rips off his shirt, jumps in the water, pulls this drowning man out, puts him on the beach. At this point, Watchman Nee is furious. What is wrong with you? You're so sadistic. What are you thinking? Letting this person suffer, thinking that he's coming to his own death, and then you're just standing there. Well, he replies, he had to come to an end of himself before he would receive my help. So true. So true. And God kind of is working like that in our life. And he's saying, how many times do you have to go under and flail before you finally concede that the seas are greater than you, that you do not have the resources that you need for your life? When will you surrender? See, this blind man was at that place. He had surrendered, and Jesus responded to that. And then there was a response of gratitude. He's seeing, and now he's following Jesus, and he's giving glory to God. Thank God. Thank God, because he's so merciful. What he's done for me, I want you all to know the goodness of God. Well, there's a contrast right there. What he saw, the disciples could not see. I like this. This is amazing grace, you know. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. It's the whole thing. Newton understood this very well. Then we go to chapter 19, verse 1. This is the second part of the thing. Jesus entered Jericho, and he was passing through. And there was a man called Zacchaeus, and he was a chief tax collector, and he was rich. And Zacchaeus was trying to see who Jesus was and was unable because of the crowd, for he was small in stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree in order to see Jesus, for he was about to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up. And he said to Zacchaeus, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for today I must stay at your house. Interesting. He just saw him up in that tree, and he's like, I got a date with you. So he hurried, and he came down and received him gladly. And when they saw it, whoever they are, they're religious, of course, they all grumbled, saying, "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." And Zacchaeus stopped, "Behold, Lord, half of my possessions I will give to the poor, and if I've defrauded anyone of anything, I will repay them fourfold." And Jesus said, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham, for the Son of Man has come to seek and save what's lost." So here's our second example of sight. A lesson from a sinner. What's the lesson? Well, it's the same lesson as the blind beggar. Okay, there's a certain consistency here. He realizes the situation he's in. He's a chief tax collector, and he's rich. There are tax collectors, and then there are, well, tax collectors. And so it's like kind of a pyramid thing, where I'm a tax collector, and I can, under with the authority and resources of the Roman government, namely the spear of the centurion behind me, I can say, "I'm the tax man, and pay up. How much you got? Okay, I'll take all of it." Right? That's how that worked. But imagine a tax gatherer who has a whole fleet of tax gatherers working for him. That's this guy. This is a chief tax gatherer. And so he became famously rich by extorting from everyone in his community. Yes, there's a certain amount that Rome is due, but 3 and 4, 5, 6, 7-fold more I keep for myself. So here are these people who are becoming rich off of the exploitation of the masses, using the authority of a totalitarian state that is occupying Israel. These people were despised for very good reason. Can you imagine what some of these people, how cold-hearted it would be to take somebody who's a sustenance-level farmer and say, "I'm taking your food while I can't eat." Well, that's just tough. See, this kind of thing. So Zacchaeus knew who he was, and that where he stood with God as a result of that, and where he stood with everyone he knew as well. So there's a humility that we see in him that is similar to the humble circumstance of the blind beggar. But there's an act of seeking on this guy's part, just as there was with the blind beggar, who cries out twice to the embarrassment of those who are around him, "Son of Man, Son of David." Zacchaeus, the little guy, had a vision problem too, which is, namely, that he was short. And it's like, you know, it wasn't working. He was getting tired, or he couldn't see, or he got tired of bobbling, I guess. I don't know what it was. But the point is that he had to move. And so he went and he climbed a tree so that as Jesus was coming by, yes, now I can hear him, now I can see him, now I can connect with this guy that I have heard about. And now I behold, I want to see this guy. I want to hear from him. Here's a guy whose life, whose way of living, you know, that's really kind of caught up with him at this point. He's interested in dealing with his denial, with his past refusals. And he's realizing that there is a problem that I can no longer ignore, and I need some help outside of me. And how about it? This Jesus. Maybe he'll give me that help. And really, I think, you know, that's kind of what it's all about. We don't know to what really Zacchaeus knew about the good news of Jesus Christ. All we know is that he had come to an end of his resources, and that he was willing to seek, and that seeking took him to this place where Jesus, they could lock eyes, they could connect, and the seeking is rewarded in three ways in this passage. It's very interesting. Jesus apparently was able to see right into this man's heart, and he spoke to him a message that he later calls salvation. Salvation. And what does it mean? First, it means, he says, today I must stay at your house. What does that mean? That means that he's extending himself and is willing to identify himself with this man who is a complete outcast from his own community. This guy is bad news. And yet, Jesus seemed like he was going to feel okay and going and having a meal with this real bad guy. This is a guy that you would not want to be friends with. This is a guy that will offend you in every imaginable way. He's not a good man. But that's okay with Jesus. He is okay to hang with the outsider. And so this guy who is a total reject from his own community, Jesus is like, but I don't reject you. Now, it's objectively true that what you're about is detestable. But I want to move toward you. And there's no place, and this is the beautiful thing in the Gospels, there's no place that Jesus is not willing to go to connect with people. There's no place Jesus is unwilling to go to meet you. And so, yes, you've got some things going on in your life, and you feel very much on the outside, and maybe you are. Maybe you've just been following a way of life that has just made people stay a bit of a distance from you, or maybe that's just driven you from people. Maybe you're deeply committed to your own fellowship outwardly, but inwardly there's an ocean of distance that separates you from everyone else. And that ocean of difference is the stuff that's going on in your own heart, and no one's talking about that. No one knows what's going on, and you are alone, stewing in your own juices, right? And Jesus is willing to meet you there, right there. He is not offended by you. And so there is this desire for him to have close fellowship, close contact with you. In the ancient world, to have a meal with somebody, to stay at their house, is the highest form of honor. And Jesus is honoring this man. Not because he's a good man, but because he's a man full of dignity. Why is he full of dignity? Because he's created in the image of God, just as all people are. And it doesn't matter how broken we are. That image is always there. And there is something worth preserving, worth saving. And Jesus moves towards this guy. He's going to have a conversation with him that is going to change his life in this world, and where he goes in the life after this. He says to him, and this is pretty powerful. He says, he too is a son of Abraham. The tax gatherer was exiled from their community. They were considered no longer, they had surrendered their place in the promise of God, namely to be a child of Abraham. Because why? Because they've taken up with the Roman cause. They're exploiting their own people. The price of that exploitation is that you are now out of God's plan, period. There is no hope for you. And Jesus is saying something very much to the contrary. He's saying, despite what you've done and despite what they're saying, you are a son of Abraham. Who you are is not connected with what have I done, okay? I'll deal with the problem of your guilt because I love you. Okay, that's the point that he's making here. You haven't lost that important standing as a child of Abraham. You're not out of the running for the experience of God's promise. And then he says, finally, the Son of Man has come to seek and save what is lost. And buddy, you are lost. You're just lost. There's nothing about your life that doesn't say a lost all over it. Walk around with your big L, you are lost. Okay, everything you've been about is lost. The value that you put on your neighbors, lost. What you do with all of your wealth, lost. What you do in these parties that you put on, lost. What you've done to substitute a relationship with me, with all of these things, lost. You're lost, lost, lost. Are you lost? Because if you recognize, you know, I'm lost. Whatever the way forward is, I don't know what that is. I'm in the weeds. And Jesus says, well, that then you really qualify as the kind of person I'm interested in. Because you realize that. You realize that which other people who outwardly are more put together than you are in denial about or in refusal about. And so there's a softness in this guy's heart because he knows that he's lost. And the people who are lost are the ones that the Son of Man has come to seek and save. And so that humility, that seeking that is represented both by the blind man and by Zacchaeus offer a really sharp and poignant contrast to the lack of understanding of Jesus' own disciples who were privy to a great deal more revelation than they were. So let's just bring it on home. We'll say a couple of things. First, about the gratitude that Zacchaeus had matches as well the same gratitude that the blind man had. I'll give half of my possessions. If I've wronged anyone, I'll repay them fourfold. That's a funny statement, if I have defrauded anyone of anything. His whole entire life is defrauding. So basically, he's about ready to take a vow of poverty. Let's bring it home. The heart of a spiritual seeker, what is that? There are just a few things here. And it begins with this super important place, this heart check. This heart check. What is really at stake for you in this thing that is being brought to your attention by God? And that you need to think about, because there is something that bristles within us when we hear things that are true but which are inconvenient, when we hear things that are true but they are uncomfortable for us. And so then we move toward denial, and we move toward distractions, just getting it out of my mind, and we move toward just a refusal. That our hearts are able to do that. I was thinking this week, I had a very difficult conversation with a friend of mine. He was bringing some things to my attention from his perspective. You're bullheaded. You don't listen. You've got some pride issues here, brother. And so what did I say? Oh, man, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that. Just makes my day. Instinctively, I'm like, oh, but wait, right? You clearly don't have the whole picture. Or you wouldn't have that kind of assessment of me, right? What is that? That's denial, okay? Because what he's saying is true. Whether it's there's more to the story than that, that's right, but that's part of the story. But we find ourselves confronted with these things, and where we allow our hearts to go, that's a very, very important thing. And many of us have had for most of our life by now really able, canned responses to keep the things that God is saying to us at a safe and comfortable distance. And God is very much interested in piercing through that. And so there is both the understanding of things. That's important. There's an intellectual component of this. But to be a spiritual seeker is also one who has their heart in check. Jeremiah says that the heart is deceitful beyond all things. Who can understand it? And that's my heart and yours also. So there is this need, if we want to hear from God, to be able to examine, to reflect, to know about the things in our own hearts that keep that at a distance, whether they're religious things, in terms of how we want to view ourselves. Maybe that we have brought some things up about, God, past experiences with Christian people. There are all manner of things that the heart conjures up to keep things at a comfortable distance when God has some things to say to us that are hard to hear, but we need to hear so that we can experience the life that He gives us on the basis of His mercy. So there's this bad news piece that precedes the good news of what God is going to give to us in His generosity. And our hearts are so often in the way. Why are you fighting in your marriages? Why are you squaring off with your kids? Why can't you get it on with your roommates in a victorious way? Why? Your heart. That's why. And so to be aware that I may be having some problems with hearing from God because of my own inward dislike for what that is going to require. But then to turn and to actually seek and explore. That's what the blind man does. That's what Zacchaeus does. So graphically, they go, they open their mouth, they make their request, they climb the tree, they find out what they can find out. What do you need to find out to really address these things that God is bringing to your attention? You're here tonight because you sense that there's something real in what God has spoken to us about through His Word. You've got some questions about that, some doubts perhaps. That's pretty normal, okay? But what do you do about that? Seek, explore, get your questions out on the table, engage, think it through. God's not afraid of your questions, and there are answers. Seek that out. And then lastly, is to act on what you know. That's what Zacchaeus did. That's what Bartimaeus, the blind man, did also. They responded concretely with actions. What does it mean? What does it mean to come to this place where, okay, uncle, I get it. I've got a problem that I can't resolve between myself and God. What do I do about that? Well, the action step here tonight would be, why don't you receive the gift of forgiveness that comes through Jesus Christ? See, that's the Christian message. Not what we do for God, but what He's done for us. It is the message that says, all I'm asking is for you to acknowledge what everyone knows to be true, and you, I suppose, last of all, you got problems. Okay? You don't think you got problems? Ask anyone close to you. They're going to tell you, hey, man, you got problems. Okay? They're alienating problems. And just if I'm at that place, then I'm prepared to receive what I cannot earn. That's grace. That's the grace of God. Are you ready for that tonight? Just to open your heart and to receive forgiveness. Maybe you're one who has made this kind of a decision a long time ago, but you have found yourself drifting, and that there are some attitudes that you've cultivated. You've gone your own way, and you kind of have liked going your own way until you didn't like going your own way. But now it's very difficult for you to connect the dots in your life between what's broken in your heart and what's wrong in your life. And God, through His Word, through spiritually minded and caring friends who are moving towards you, are engaging some of these things in your life. And you know, you're like, I get it, but then I lose it. I have clarity and then it vanishes. You know what I'm talking about? You know what that's like? I get clarity, I see it, and then a couple days later, that clarity is like, what was that again? What was that insight I once had about myself that just seemed so true? I can't remember. Why can't you remember? Because you did not act on what you knew. That's why. And so here, these guys, Bartimaeus, what did he do? Once, when God, in his mercy, healed him, he glorified God, it says. He went and he followed Jesus. What did Zacchaeus do? He gave away what he had. He invited Jesus into his home. He did. And it is in the doing that the confidence is really distilled in our lives. That is how our hearts stay soft to God and we continue to hear from him. So I think this is a great story. It's something that we really need to think about as a disciple. That yes, I need to engage my mind. I need to learn what does it mean to represent Christ effectively, to know him, to know his word. But none of that will matter unless my heart is in that humble place, in that soft place, in that place where only those without their own resources can truly understand. Yeah? Let's just call it quits right there.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.